Our speaker today, Royal Arch Gunnison, comes to us in an amiable frame of mind, but he speaks to us, I'm afraid, slightly hungry. He spent 17 months, more or less, in Japanese concentration camps on a daily diet of fish, and was slightly surprised to find that he had the same diet facing him here. Mr. Gunnison began his newspaper career as the Associated Press correspondent at Geneva in 1934. He spent some time in Berlin, in Paris, and I think in London. In 1940, he took an extended tour throughout the Orient, covering some 100,000 miles, and many of us will recall that he made an extended report to this club upon his return. A good many of the things he said were prophetic in character. They've come true. Mr. Gunnison comes back to San Francisco, to the place which he regards as his home, because he spent about 4 years here as correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Mr. Gunnison will speak to us today on the subject, Whose Peace, Ours or Japan's? He speaks with authority. I dare say that some of the things that he's about to say will be amplified in a book of his, which will come off the press, if newsprint can be obtained, sometime in July, entitled So Sorry, No Peace. Those of you who are interested might want to bear that in mind. Mr. Gunnison.
Mr. Crum, ladies and gentlemen, I see there are two ladies and my wife. Well, it's needless to say that I am delighted to be back here in San Francisco, which really is our home, although we're temporarily living in New York City. It has been exactly 3 years, 3 months, a few days, a few minutes, and a few seconds, and we've looked forward to this opportunity of coming back, and particularly of returning here to the Commonwealth Club. Stuart Ward had a cable waiting for me at Goa, which was one of the first welcoming messages that I had in getting back to the position of being a free citizen again. So it was a real welcome back from the Commonwealth Club at that time. So it's just a homecoming today, and I'd like to just discuss with you. I don't want to talk at anybody. I just want to talk with all the old friends here in San Francisco today. And I want to talk with you about this subject of our enemy, the Jap. No one needs to tell you about dealing with Japanese. You have been dealing here on the West Coast with Japanese of all types for a long time. No one needs to tell you of the perfidy of the Japanese. No one needs to tell you of the unreliability of the Japanese. No one needs to tell you that the fundamental education of the Japanese is based very close to untruthfulness through and through and through. And that is the type of thing that we are going to face when the fighting stops. Now, we have been trying to understand our enemy, the Jap, just as we've been trying to understand our enemy, the German. And as a military enemy, we now pretty much have the number of the Jap, and we pretty much have the number of the German. Now there is no doubt that regardless of the number of men that it may take, the amount of ammunition and supply that it may take, nor the length of time gentlemen, that it may take, we are going to smash the German and the Jap completely. But that is only the beginning. Our real job begins when the fighting stops. And there is where your job and where my job and where all of us have a terrific responsibility. We must not leave it up to a few who are planning or who are not planning, people whom we may feel we can depend upon or whom we may feel we cannot depend upon or whom we may feel we do not want to depend upon. This is an American problem, pure and simple. We have fighting allies, and we're going to have allies in the stability period that follows. But fundamentally, this is a selfish war. Nobody enters a war. Nobody gets into a fight unless he himself is brought into it. And he himself has something to get out of it. Either he's defending or he's aggressive. The stability period must be aggressive. That's all there is to it, and we might as well wake up and realize that fact right now. Great things are going to be happening in the next few months. Great things in Europe and great things in the Pacific. Now, we are able to say that for the first time, independent action is being taken in the Pacific. And by independent action, I mean that regardless of what happens in Europe, whether it is good or whether it is bad, the program in the Pacific is going ahead. It's going to move along. We have the supplies, the equipment, the men, and the plan. And it is going to proceed according to plan. I think we're all very happy about that because it's the first time that we have reached this point in our war effort. Now, we agree that we're going to smash the Japanese. We agree that he is going to receive no quarter until he is licked militarily. And the Japanese themselves are beginning to realize that exactly that is happening. Exactly that is going to happen. That is the higher crust Japanese. The average Japanese doesn't realize it at all. Many of them think they're fighting now in Florida or in Australia. You've seen those reports that have come back. Their propaganda is pretty effective. Actually, there has been no real fighting in the Pacific yet. We're just beginning to get up on the road to Tokyo. We're going to see an awful lot of it this year, before the year is out. Some sensational, spectacular things. But we must remember that it's a long way to the end of this war. Well, when that end comes, the Japanese hierarchy, the upper crust, the planners, Tojo and company, and those who will follow him, have designed a 100 years secret weapon, an underground war, to begin the moment the fighting stops, to avenge the dishonorable defeat. It cannot be an honorable peace in any sense of the word for the Japanese. That's impossible. They are trained from the moment they are able to think that they must hate the white man, that they must hate the foreigner, and that someday little Jiro Japanese is going to fight us, is going to eliminate us from the entire area that they call East Asia. And the Japanese have impregnated this idea of Asia for the Asiatic throughout Greater East Asia. When we defeat Japan, that idea will still remain. That is an idea that we will have to contend with in the future. We will have to be wiser, more clear-headed than we have ever been in our dealings throughout Greater East Asia because of that one slogan, that open sesame, that anyone can pick up out there and use. We want to be certain that the Japanese never do it. Now, the Japanese in planning this, what's behind this 100 years war? What is behind their program? I underwent hours and days of interrogation by Japanese of all kinds, from the gendarmerie, which is the equivalent of their Gestapo, to their army, the naval landing party, and the consular corps. Very interestingly, just before we were repatriated, I was taken out of camp four times and given a course of sprouts by the Japanese. One, a sub-cabinet officer who was over in Shanghai from Tokyo, a course of sprouts on how we had misunderstood the Japanese, how they really should have all of the greater East Asia area, Oceania, how they should control China, their brothers, and how I should go home and tell all you folks about it. So I'm telling you about it now, you see. During these periods of questioning, some of which were pretty grueling, although I will admit that I got off very lightly in comparison with some of the people. Of course, you realize that all Japanese correspondents are trained espionage agents. Therefore, all American correspondents are spies, and that's all there is to it, and there's nothing you can do to convince them otherwise. Well, I found that one of the best defense mechanisms in these questioning periods was that of trying to ask them questions. And I would find that sometimes I would be able to, and especially those of a higher rank. And throughout the entire period of nearly 2 years, this is one theme that ran throughout the questioning period. One theme in regard to their policy, and it's this. They say, Gunsan, my name fits Japanese too well. They just put that san on there, and you'd think I were Japanese. And they'd call me down, and they'd say, hey, Gunsan, come in. So in I'd go, and they'd say, why your country not realize Japan has already won war? They read an article that was published in Collier's Magazine by Clark Lee, in which Clark said that the Japanese at that point had won their war, and now they were going to try to hang on to what they held. And this one deputy commandant that we had, his name was Inaba. We called him Kobe Joe. Well, he was a marvelous person. He wore a green checkered suit with shoes that he could slip in and out of. He had terrific horn-rimmed glasses and all the teeth that Tokyo can provide. He came over to my room the last day before we were repatriated, and he came in and he pulled up his green trousers to the knees and slipped out of his shoes and tucked his feet under him and sat on my broken-down cot and said, Gunsan, I am very sorry to see you go. Well, I didn't say anything. he said, you know, when this war is over, I come to America. And so I raised my eyebrows. He said, when I come to America, I will be guest in your home. And I said, Mr. Inaba, when you come to America, I guarantee I will give you the greatest welcome any Japanese ever received. And he never got it. Those minor victories meant a great deal to us. Well, the feeling of the Japanese on the basis of their policy is this, that they have won their war, and they say, why do you not recognize that our government has taken what is rightfully ours? That this belongs to us, that it always has belonged to us, and now we have taken it honestly from you. Why do you send two men to our one? Why do you send three planes to our one? Why do you send extra tanks, extra ships, extra submarines? This is not fair. In other words, gentlemen, we are playing dirty pool. Now that is the basis upon which they will lay their propaganda for this 100 years war to begin against us the moment the fighting stops. That is where our whole trouble is going to begin. We Americans and British, we Anglo-Saxons, don't know what a real game of delay and stall and blocking is. If the Japanese, who were in our camps, in charge of our camps, had planned for 20 or 30 or 40 years to block us, to prevent us from having the things that we should have had, the medicines that we should have had, they gave us no medicine. The food that we should have had at Santo Tomas for the first 6.5 months, which they did not provide. Anything of that kind, if they'd planned it out on paper, they couldn't have done a better job. Now, that is the sort of thing that we're going to meet when we come up against them, and this is over. We're coming up against the type of person whom you know and whom I know as a person who is so imbued with hate and a fanatical superman, as Admiral Halsey calls them, super monkeys. Okay. With the idea that they are going to be so superior, whether it takes 1 year, 10 years, or 20 years, that they will never let down. They are fighting this war, gentlemen, every single minute. They take no time out for anything. They're constantly thinking war. And that's the thing that we must get in the back of our heads. When this is over, they're not going to stop. They cannot stop. It's not in their systems to stop. Take the type of Japanese atrocity that we hear about. Now, those are true. Those stories that you read are true because they have been authenticated. I have published some in Collier's. I've spoken on the air. I've told some. You've read the Dias stories and the others. Those are authenticated stories to which we will have to sign affidavits. We've either seen them with our own eyes or we've gotten them firsthand, and they don't go any farther than that. Now, we in America and in Britain have a very difficult time to try to analyze the kind of human thinking that will permit other human beings throughout the world to commit atrocities of that kind. Well, now, to the Japanese, those are not atrocities. Those are committed by sane Japanese. There is no such thing, gentlemen, as a Japanese hero. There is no such thing as going beyond your line of duty. Anything and everything that you do as a Japanese soldier is considered part and parcel of your duty. Now, those are the people we're up against. Many of those men who are doing that right now are going to come back when this is over. And they are the people that we are going to have to contend with. That is where our problem lies, fundamentally in the Japanese thinking when this thing is over. Now, here's another example. One of the questions asked me and asked many other people during our internment and imprisonment period was this. Why, in the 1923 earthquake, did the United States send millions of dollars of medicines and other aid to Japan when Japan lay helpless at the foot of America? They say, why did you do this? Did you not realize we were at war with you then? Did you not realize that we were planning this very war now? Why were you suckers? Well, there's no answer to it. I've checked with naval officers since I've been back. Men who went into Yokohama, Tokyo Harbor, with the first flotilla of 5 destroyers that went in with this, the first medicines. They were the first ships that were able to get in there. And when they got outside the harbor, what did they find? They found a segment of the Japanese fleet drawn up in battle formations with guns uncorked. And they didn't know what to expect, and neither did the Japanese. But when the Japanese saw that there were only 5 destroyers, they let them come into the harbor, but they did not permit them to unload until minesweepers came alongside later and unloaded. They just cannot get it through their minds and into their heads how we could be so stupid as to realize, as they think we must, that they were planning a war against us, that they were planning to drive us out of Greater East Asia and still come in and help them prepare themselves to fight us, to pull off a Pearl Harbor. They just cannot understand it. And they say, if they're that stupid, maybe they're going to be stupid again. Well, now, are we or aren't we? That's up to us. And we have got to plan it very carefully. I say that Hirohito is a greater symbol of aggression and hate against America, against Britain, against the American way of life, against the four freedoms, against all of our principles than Hitler or Mussolini ever could possibly be. And therefore, gentlemen, if we are going to eliminate Hitler and Mussolini, then we must eliminate Hirohito. Now, how that is going to be done, I don't know. Personally, I don't care much. It can be done in a very nice and polite way in Japan. He can just pass out of the picture. How it is done, we can leave up to Japanese with whom we will have to deal when this is over. Now, I'd like to just mention that fact. There are people who believe that there are Japanese, that there are a number of Japanese underground, way underground, who are so-called liberals. Japanese with whom we can deal. Japanese who are friendly to us and to our way of living and thinking and doing. That, I believe, is a false estimate. There are Japanese who understand that Japan must get along in a world that most Japanese do not understand. There are Japanese who realize that Japan itself lives in a vacuum, the way I like to look at it. Here are these islands. There is a language wall, a language vacuum. There is a physical vacuum, and there certainly is a thought vacuum in Japan. Otherwise, they could not perpetrate this theory of the Shinto religion and the mystic emperor who is still a blood relation of each and every one of us if we were Japanese. They couldn't get away with this semi-feudal state if the people in Japan knew what was going on in the rest of the world from a social point of view. That vacuum has got to be cracked, ladies and gentlemen, and we have got to go in there over a period of years, of generation after generation, with a business foreign service, as well as our political foreign service, an educational and propaganda foreign service, backed up thoroughly by force, which is the only thing the Japanese understand, the only thing the Germans really understand. We cannot do what we did after the last war with the Germans, for instance. I covered the League of Nations in 1934, and I saw that thing begin to totter. And one of the reasons was, I am convinced, that when the war was over, we said to the Germans, well, you sure fixed that. Now we're going to fix you. When we think that you are capable of coming back into the family of nations, well, we'll let you know when you can come back. We have got to take the Germans here and the Japanese there and fit them right into the new world situation, the new world set up, and we have got to say to the Japanese, these are your responsibilities. You are going to fulfill them. As far as Asia goes, as far as the rest of the world goes, we're going to know where every drop of oil goes, where every strip of cotton goes, where every scrap piece of iron goes. We're going to know exactly how Japan is living. Now, this may seem to be a difficult thing. From a strictly business point of view, from a strictly educational point of view, or a strictly propaganda point of view, and administrative, it may seem difficult. It may even seem crazy, but I am sincere in saying this, that if we do not do it, we are going to face them again. It is a matter, gentlemen, of self-preservation. I am convinced that the Japanese have planned this for a long time, and that they are not going to stop planning when they are defeated. It is merely going to incite them to greater action. That is my feeling about it very, very sincerely. Now, since I've been back, I have been traveling about half the time. I've been back almost 5 months. I've been in Washington a great deal. Every time I go down there, I try to call on a few cabinet officers, and I do. I've been traveling in the Midwest and in the South, and this out here on the West Coast. Here on the West Coast, people are more aware, naturally, to the problems of the Japanese in the future. We are more alert out here to that problem. In the East Coast, they are alert to a certain extent, but they are closer to the European situation, and they are watching that cat-like at the moment. In the Midwest, they are neither fish nor fowl, perhaps fowl. That is some of them. But they, as a whole, are not particularly alert to planning for the future in the Far East. Now, there is no such thing as a sensible blueprint for foreign policy, either in Europe or in the Far East. And those snipers who are going after a direct clause-by-clause foreign policy are just snipers, and that's all there is to it. But there are certain fundamental principles in dealing with the Germans, in dealing with the occupied countries, in dealing with the Japanese, that we must enunciate, that we must lay down immediately, and that it will do no harm to bring out in the open and show. So far, I have been unable to find a united policy. The Army and the Navy are pretty clear on what they want to do. The State Department is not clear on what it wants to do. Other departments are trying to work out policy, but there is no one that is coordinating it. Now, the people on the West Coast have a right to know what this is. The people in the Midwest have a right to know what it is or what it's going to be, and the people in the East have a right to know. The Japanese are depending upon us to become war-weary, to become so concerned with what's happening in Europe, because they believe that that's going to take a good deal longer than we expect it to. They believe that our families are going to say, well, my son has fought in Europe, let somebody else fight in the Far East. Or if the Japanese offer some kind of a peace proposition through a third party, they'll say, well, even though it isn't completely unconditional, they've offered it, let's accept it. Let's quit all this fighting. We don't like it. Now, that is exactly what the Japanese are depending upon. We will win the fighting. There's no doubt about it. The Japanese haven't even begun yet to realize that they're licked. And that's going to take some doing. Even though we expect a long, hard battle against the Nips, now is the time to start planning on winning the war, the real fight for supremacy, and the stability that won't even begin until the fighting stops. If the United States ever faced a bold challenge, it does in the figurative Bronx cheer that the Jap high officials are now giving Uncle Sam regarding the prospect of surrender terms, the peace terms, and the enforcement of the peace and stability terms. Now, I've had high Jap officials laugh in my face and spit on the floor in derision when they mentioned the outside possibility of the United States winning the peace after the fighting stops. These Jap officials admit the possibility that Japan may not win the fighting. But it is impossible for us to lose the peace, they often sneered. You Americans, they say, and British, are bigger suckers than anyone in the world. You helped us build ourselves up to fighting strength after you had us at your mercy following the 1923 earthquake. You will become war-weary, they've told me. Then your soft, stupid people, your isolationists, will be willing to accept any kind of peace proposals. They say you will never get unconditional surrender. You will never win that much face out here. And face, gentlemen, is everything out there, as you know. High Japanese officials, including Tojo, hardly expected to completely win this war, but they fully expected to come out of it with a net gain. And even though they may lose what territory they expected to gain, they will use every means at their disposal to win a primary psychological victory. Since I've been back in the United States, I have talked, as I said, with a number of cabinet officers. Frankly speaking, on this whole foreign policy situation, and there are people here today who will disagree with me on this, but I am convinced that if the Japanese were smart, they'd quit this war within 24 hours and they'd catch us in such a predicament that we wouldn't know what to do next. There'd be a terrific lag. Everybody would rush around and say, now what are we going to do? You see confusion and perplexity in the eyes, and you find it in the minds of our high officialdom when they come to discuss the Japanese. It isn't because they don't want to impose the most effective terms on the Jap. It's not that. It's just the plain, unvarnished fact that most of our top policymakers, and I'm sorry to have to include the venerable Mr. Cordell Hull in this category, just do not understand even the reason the Japs are fighting us, nor do they understand even partially the fundamental hatred and aggressive pugnaciousness held by each and every Jap against us. And this goes, as I said before, for the Mitsubishis and the Mitsuis and all those others. Just because Joseph Grew told Mr. Hull that the emperor told somebody who told somebody else that he, the emperor, that's Charlie to those of us in the Far East, that Charlie did not want to go to war against the United States, dear old Mr. Hull somehow thinks that it's going to be perfectly all right to sign this final peace and stability terms with Hirohito. And I've talked to Mr. Hull about it, and I'm sure that it isn't because he doesn't want to understand that situation out there. He just cannot seem to get it. He cannot seem to understand that Hirohito is the greatest, the most dangerous symbol of fanatical hatred and aggression against us and the British and any other white nation of any symbol, any rallying point in the world today. Hirohito is a much more dangerous man to have alive when the war is over than Hitler or our bug-eyed friend Mussolini. If our government and the British and the Chinese permit the Japs to hornswoggle us into signing any kind of a conditional peace term with Hirohito, regardless of how harsh or realistic they may appear, these conditional terms, that will be the first step towards another Pearl Harbor. Despite the fact that any switchover in public opinion can be made in the name of the emperor in Japan, in the switchover of their thinking, no switchover is planned in this avenge the dishonorable peace, the dishonorable defeat policy that's now building in the minds of the Japanese people. The moment defeat smashes against Japan, the propaganda machine there will get in quick licks before the Allied occupational armies land in Japan. These propagandists in Japan will tell the people, never mind what His Imperial Japanese Majesty says in his rescript announcing the peace. He doesn't mean it. He can't mean it. That is, if we sign this thing with Hirohito. They'll say, don't you let this on to the hated foreigner. Smile to him, say, oh, I am so sorry, and blame it on Tojo and the others. But never let him know, the foreigner know, that you're beginning right now to plan for the first sign of weakness from the enemy. You begin by taking an inch here, an inch there. You gain face each time the foreigner shows the inevitable weakness of the white man's benevolence in victory. The emperor doesn't mean what he says. How could he? He hates the foreigner more than you do. And you must continue to hate the foreigner while appearing to cooperate with him. Follow Hirohito, they'll say, to avenge the dishonorable defeat, and you will receive your instructions from time to time. Now, I say that a new emperor, whether he's the young crown prince or someone else, can be instructed by us through this so-called liberal cabinet that will eventually come up that we will have to deal with. And as long as we deal with them realistically, knowing that they hate us, but they realize still that they've got to do business with us, we cannot go directly to the Japanese people. We have got to hang our program for Japan upon the present Japanese technical setup. We cannot do away with Shinto. Many people say, sure, clean it out, clean out the political shrines and all that. We have certain principles for which we're fighting. One of those is freedom of religion. Now, you can say that Shinto is a religion or it's not a religion. But whatever it is, it's the religion of the Japanese people. And if we take it away from them, we give them something to fight for. You cannot do what some others would say. Take every able-bodied Japanese from the age of, say, 15 to 45. When this is over, take them out and shoot them. Of course, the Japanese might try something like that if they took us over. But we cannot do that. But we must go in, we must try to break the line between politics and religion where the emperor is concerned. We have got to show the Japanese people that while they can still worship an emperor, if they want to, that they can still live a better life in Japan, that they've got something to contribute to the world, and that, by golly, we're going to see to it that they contribute it or else, and that they're not going to contribute any more war. Now, if you think that that sounds like Hollywood, or you think it sounds fantastic, think again. This is a war to the finish with the Jap. And if we do not start out when this war is over treating the Japanese in exactly the ruthless way he would expect to treat us were he to win this war, we will have lost sufficient face for the Jap to gain immediate confidence. The Jap will wait patiently for the day our people here at home become war-weary or slightly forgetful. Sure, we'll say, in 5 or 10 years, my, don't they do their hair in a nice way? And aren't they wonderful at arranging flowers? And, oh, now, aren't they so polite? And they're always saying, so sorry, Mr. Tojo, a very bad man. We do not like to do business Mr. Tojo's way. So sorry. Sure, they're sorry. They're just sorry that they haven't got the knife in farther. At the moment we become the benevolent victors, the next Oriental war will have received full throttle. Specifically, I'm extremely apprehensive of these factors, which I'm firmly convinced must be corrected and prevented. If we don't, we will have lost the victory, the stability, before we have even got started. And these are the factors. First, that Japan will quit before we get any definite, agreed-upon plan and policy coordinated between the armed forces and the international political influences, and thus they'll catch us without a program and at a bad disadvantage. Secondly, that Mr. Hull and his State Department staff will be satisfied to make an agreement following surrender with the present emperor and thus unwittingly lay the basis for another Hirohito-inspired hate war to be started and fanned from underground. The Japanese will say, well, if Hirohito and Tojo did it, then Hirohito and Yamaguchi can do it, or somebody else. Third, that certain segments of our national population will become war-weary. I know the Japanese plan to offer us, through our ally Soviet Russia, at a critical moment, a peace plan. If Stalin refuses to pass along the surrender offer, it will be made through the Spanish, the Swiss, or the Swedes. Japan will try every subterfuge to arrange a surrender indirectly rather than come out straightforwardly to us and admit they've been licked. It's a loss of face. If we're stupid enough to accept a second-hand offer for peace or anything less than unconditional surrender from the Jap, we have started to lose the peace. Fourth, that the United States Army and Navy may be kept from treating the defeated Jap in a rough, tough, and intelligent manner by certain political elements within our present government, elements which find it impossible to realize that every Jap is a liar, that every Jap hates the foreigner, that every Jap will feel that he himself somehow must eventually try to personally avenge the dishonorable defeat. These blind elements in our government are unable to see that every Jap is anti-foreign, whether he's businessman or a militarist or a so-called independent cultural leader, Kagawa, for instance. It's only over the method of elimination of the white man that the Japs argue, not the end. And these Japs depend upon us to be the sucker, the prime sucker in the world. And they believe that we believe that some Japs are friendly. Don't believe it. Never believe it. Remember that the Japanese train their children and their young men right up to the last moment to think that we always will be suckers. Fifth, that once victorious, we will become too benevolent. And I am definitely apprehensive lest we become too complacent in believing that once the Nazis and the Japs are licked, there will be no more wars, no more fighting, and that we'll relax. There's too much hate running wild throughout the world today and the Far East. And this Asia for the Asiatic slogan still will pack a terrific wallop. I believe, gentlemen, that our only hope is to become so aroused in these United States of ours that we trust no one in the world, including some of our own mamby-pamby, muddle-thinking people. We must become so aroused that we drive ourselves out of complacency into a state of mind that is alert, as alert as the clearest, most realistic Soviet thinking. That we never forget for a moment that we are fighting a war to keep our own way of life free, and that if incidentally we make other parts of the world safe for democratic practices, that is progress. Let's remember, we are fighting a selfish war against selfish nations. Let's be selfish enough to insist that our fighting allies take our lead in important policy matters. As to whose peace, ours or Japan's, at the moment, we are drifting in the direction of letting Japan program the kind of peace she is going to live, a program of block, stall, delay, and smirk. But there's still time to out-Jap the Jap. Treat the Jap as another Oriental victor would. That would be the most surprising, the most devastating, and permanent defeat he could receive. And I say, why not try it? Gentlemen, let's quit following somebody else's lead. Let's make history. Thank you.